Blog Talk Radio.
An influence on modernism, the mind among minds, particularly Albert Einstein. I'm going to share some of his poetry with you today. And then we'll do a dive into the symbolism that begs the question. As you're listening to this, my goodness, this is the attention to detail, my brethren. And here on Masonic Effects, I only never claim to be doing more than scratching the surface of some wide ideas. Just incredible. So in the back of my mind, I've been reading, again, the context of our development. Particularly, some of you will appreciate the impact of John Wyvil, Wycliffe, it's 1382, the Bible, and then the follow-up in 1525 of William Tyndale, around the time of the Protestant Reformation, first English language Bible. Well, the backlash here. Let's sit and I hope you'll enjoy I'm very much in the Christmas season. I'll put a fire on during the show and warm their room up and sip as they tend to. And I hope you'll be entertained and informed, as you well deserve. It's not every day that this time comes along. It's and we're more fortunate than most, aren't we? Yeah, truly. We're blessed to have each other and family and memories of Frank. Understanding, and we make the best of what we have. We find joy where we are, and a smile that we bring to the room is infectious. Remember our values only gain value when we don't have any reason to employ them, when we have every reason to react without control, usually with temper, and yet we don't. We find the broader side of the bigger man. Commentary for you today. Yeah. Thank you. Sit back, get comfortable, and tell me what you think. You can always respond to this at masonic effects@gmail.com. Yeah. Here, the title of this is Whence Come We? You've heard me talk about discovery. As a little boy walking along the north shores of Prince Edward Island after a storm, it was all discovery, pockets full of them. And I've shared with you the sense that process of masonry is fluid discovery. But indulge me with a further observation. It's hard to stay focused. Here is a perspective that helps us to sustain the effort we need. Imagine we are at the door of the Hagia Sophia, standing there with anticipation. As we step inside, we're overwhelmed by an architecture unlike anything we have seen, designed to hold a repository of knowledge distilled from time and cultures of the world. A mosque built on a temple. A history of conquest and malice. But emerging today as a symbol, as a connection with time gone by. We walk in. That's about when an inner voice begins its work. Am I excited? Do I like this? I don't know what to do. Do I pick up a book? What if I can't understand the ideas? I don't like this anymore. It's sunny outside. I'm leaving and you can't stop me. And so it goes when a man is unfamiliar with high-level mentoring, coaching, instruction, overwhelmed. Standing before him with a raw talent takes trust to place yourself in the hands of a man who can take you to the next level without you knowing how he's going to do that necessarily. Optimizing strength is only part of the training of those that excel. Exposing weaknesses lets us know where we need to compensate. Perhaps with that extra specific training targets to complement our natural talents. That requires control of one's ego. Listening, as someone points out, where we are vulnerable is an ingredient not explained to most of us. Wondering how to be better tomorrow than we are today, facing inadequacy alone. That is a secret prison found in our mind palace. Until you give yourself your complete effort to be the man you know yourself to be, in Masonic parlance, he is confident, understated, inspirational, secure within himself, content. Controlling the demons that a chess master knows too well when triggered will enable a man to defeat himself. Go back inside. Enjoy. Thank you. Hank Jones to settle the mind, to settle the mind. Beautiful, beautiful music. Poetry. Why would we think that it's worth a second glance? Why waste your valuable time on something that for those people, not for us. It's that artwork that is penetrating, that we don't understand. It doesn't fit with our pleasant convention, that it doesn't match the drapes. It's making a statement, it's doing something to us that elicits an emotion. It's tricking our minds. Going beyond reality into metaphysics and notions that aren't always obvious to the eye. How does that painter do that? How does that librettist put the words together to match so totally this music that leaves us in a state of frisson? Hundreds of years later, how does that happen? And why would we want to think that we're either worthy of it or want to displace something that just sifts through our minds like a handful of water? No good reason. There's a clear view, though, of the essentials of poetry, and it's brought us very close to a definition of poetry, which we happen to see in print by poets, by men of genius. We see them in the Corn Law rhymes of Ebenezer Elliott. And other poems of still greater merit. Poetry, Elliott said, is impassioned truth. Enough, enough. It's not enough that somebody else is telling me that I must be aware of their particular concern. What about my own? What are my own concerns, and how do I sort out where the priorities are? I like to be a good liberal thinker, so my goodness, I must have to be aware. And when I'm around an authoritarian, you easily know how to accommodate them, tolerate them. And even the man whose thinking is so wrong-minded and awkward, we dismiss them intellectually and avoid them. Until out of their loneliness, perhaps, the trickle-down theory will come about. And they'll ask why. So we do work in poetry because it presses us. Because we want to understand. Albert Einstein. It's remarkable. Here's an article written in at Stanford University in 2013, fairly recent, by Malin Fidler. Einstein and the triumph of truth as the metaphor of choice in modern times. In Zurich in 1919, writes Fiedler, a crowd of 1,500 reacted in a frenzy to a modernist performance led by the artist Tristan Tzara. The crowd deteriorated into hysteria, chased the performers and destroyed props. They were responding to the inhumanity and emptiness they perceived in the incomprehensible art. In the same time period, on the other hand, cheering masses welcomed Einstein, purveyor of incomprehensible science. As Charlie Chaplin famously noted, they greeted him exactly because they did not understand his new conception of physical reality. Many consider Einstein and modernism as part of the same cultural conversation. The desperate reactions of these crowds to work they did not understand then seems paradoxical. Most scholars agree that popularized forms of Einstein's work influenced modernism, but more accurate interpretations had little sway. I agree with this argument, she went on, but extend it by offering an alternative suggestion for Einstein's major influence in modern cultural works. Instead of modernism, with its fracturing of reality, multiple perspectives, and the altering of time, Einstein's work contributes to the reinvigoration and re-legitimization of absolute truth as a valid concept in modern cultural expression. Absolute truth. The perils of linking science to culture. One must balance the words of scientists, artists, and critics. Michael Whitworth, author of Einstein's Wake, Relativity, Metaphor, and Modernist Literature, and who will receive more attention later in this article, takes the position that no matter how peculiar the institution of science, there will be a degree of continuity with the outside world. Metaphors abstracted from science are no longer wholly identical to science, nor are they wholly divorced from it. Whitworth makes the case for a reciprocal conversation between science and other fields. This position is less severe than some of the opinions of artists. The 1960s adherence to modernist tradition, the Park Place Group, proclaimed space-time is the only way you can think since Einstein. This artist leaves no room for space-time being no longer wholly identical to science, but proclaims its triumph over the creative spirit. At the other end of the spectrum is literary critic Lionel Trilling. In 1972, he pronounced regarding the post-Einstein era, the operative conceptions of science are alien to the mass of educated persons. They generate no cosmic speculation. They do not engage emotion or challenge imagination. Our poets are indifferent to them. Some poets obviously disagree, embodying the difficulty of establishing rigorous connections between science and cultural expression. I have a question for you. Is it feasible then that we can proclaim masonry has been unaffected by this cultural phenomena? That the world wasn't changed by the thinking of absolute truth, the identification of absolute truth found in Einstein's mathematics? Are we claiming that the world wasn't changed by the by the work of Galileo or Copernicus or Euclid or Mandelbaum or Schopenhauer or Kant or Hume or Plato or Aristotle or the Chinese culture 5,000 years beyond us. To think this would be teetering on a conceit that we would not probably want to own. The question you ask is, why does it matter and how would that have affected us? Whence come me? Whence come me? Albert Einstein wrote this, called Solitude. It's very short. See how he did with the truth of the world. Solitude is painful when one is young, but delightful when one is more mature. I live in that solitude, which was painful in my youth. It seems delicious now in the years of my maturity. Now it gives me great pleasure indeed to see the stubbornness of the incorrigible nonconformist so warmly acclaimed, and yet it seems vastly strange to be known so universally and yet be so lonely. Solitude. These are his lines. Seven lines on morality. Still, as far as I'm concerned, I prefer silent vice to ostentatious virtue. I don't know. I don't care. And it doesn't make any difference. Did you get that chill? Thank you. to say at least greetings and let you all know who's sitting in with us today. Thank you, listeners from around the world, from Australia, Germany, Portugal, France, the stalwarts from Ghana, hello, India, United Kingdom, yes, USA, and the largest audience, thank you, Canada. So, I try not to get into the trivia of the business of lodges, because as you can see, we're filling in time, going over bills and receipts, ultimately important. They're only ultimately important if you have lost the plot. Freemasonry was never designed to bore the pants off of grown men. Ooh, we get comfortable. Throw ourselves at the work. Nobody does that. Nobody approaches the work without some peremptory lead. If you're doing the research yourself and then you step into a group where that is going to be taken, then the start is electric. You sit down. This is the specific training. At this moment, we're going to have a master class in Freemasonry. Put on your thinking caps, as the teacher used to say. Sit down, pay attention. Or if you're the supercilious genius in the room, act indolent and indifferent until something inspires you and you can actually demonstrate your capability and engagement. No need to lie about your presence of mind. The jewels, huh? I'm speaking as if you've all made that choice of Freemasonry as the avenue, as a pilgrimage to truth in modern times. Share with you some history. The ideas of Freemasonry, the soul, the authenticity came along before we had a Grand Lodge. We know this. History supports that. I make no bones. I'm not interested in the politicking, how to move Freemasonry forward and on a global level and expand it. Values driven. Let's ignore the things that divide us. Let's ignore culture and ignore religion and ignore politics and spread this search, this pathway, this ongoing conversation between adults, between men. Oh, and the conversation, if it's not enough to make the faint of heart run out of the room with their little jazz hands flung above their heads, then why bother having it? Oh, if it's not enough to upset all the piety in the atmosphere out there, then why bother doing it? We're well beyond the point where we have to do something to prove ourselves. Truly, you think of membership in Freemasonry as what validates your worth as a human being. It's like there's something more than defining ourselves by being a part of a brotherhood, by being part of a skill set, jobs, being part of a family. There's something beyond all of that. How you find it and how you make those connections, who's to say? You want something predictable, some orthodoxy to explain your life to you? All too often, Freemasonry has been blinkered by this effort to instruct as if insight and inspiration is a product of instruction. I still remember my psychiatrist telling me that we were going to have a meeting, and on this date and in this time, we were going to be spontaneous and come up with innovative ideas. And I went to him and explained it. Probably should have just remained quiet and faked it, but I explained that I can't be spontaneous on command. I don't know how to do that. Go over there and be spontaneous there, you know. I have no idea. Like you, I'm inspired by men that are inspired. People that are inspired inspire me. They intrigue me. They make me somehow want to work that graveyard shift, that make me want, that's leadership. Somebody bossing me around, I wish, I'm a terrible person, doesn't matter. Yell at me, holler, doesn't matter, I'm too old, doesn't work, been done too many times before. It's like, if that's all you got, what comes next? Get that over, you know, vent your spleen if you need it. A scapegoat, fine. I'm all for that. You know, the world needs scapegoats to manage these huge egos. But when that is done, what have you got? That's it? Because you know darn well, after you've carried on and embarrassed yourself as a grown man, it's embarrassing. It's humiliating. It's childish. It's uncontrolled. And what does Hiram F. the book tell? What does this material tell us? It doesn't tell us very much. It gives us an opportunity. You're walking through the doors of this vast library. And it is absolutely overwhelming until you begin to ask a question. And then the next. And then the next. Maybe you start with, what's this about? How's this going to affect me? What are my interests? I don't know. Should I pick something that's simple, that's so familiar to me, that I don't have to challenge myself? Or do I select something that is new? And do I go to places in my mind, in my experience, that I haven't gone before? Because it's likely that I'll find answers there that I haven't found before. We're talking about movable jewels. Make the threads, make the connections, if you will. Since 1816, the three movable jewels have been regarded as the working tools of the second degree. So that the level and plumb rule combine with the square in this connection also. As the quotation of a Reverend Mason indicates, it was a plumb line rather than a plumb rule, which was the tool indicated in the 18th century. The use of the word level does not of itself indicate the form which this implement takes. J.T. Lawrence begs leave to doubt whether the device with which the senior warden is invested is really a level or not. He has in mind that a modern level is based on the use of a bubble, and in his speculative thoughts on the level as an implement in masonry, he says this, it depends on the fact that the definition of a true level is that of the surface of a fluid when at rest. It is only at rest in the absence of any external disturbing force, or when such forces are exactly balanced. He might then regard the level as bidding us to strive to attain a disposition from all disturbing forces being absent, or are kept in perfect subjection. When I look at a bubble, I'll be honest with you, that wasn't the first thought that jumped out. Now it is. A peaceful and unruffled disposition is one to be envied, and it cannot be attained so long as our passions are apt to run away with us. We have to weigh carefully every impulse so as not to be easily swayed, first on one side and then on the other. Of course, this is an ideal and a counsel of perfection. It might be a little more generous than that, President. But if Freemasonry did not present us with ideals, and what is more, with constantly receding ideals, we should soon tire of it. Curious enough that Freemasonry isn't enough if we assume it's based on instruction. Instruction is important, particularly at the start. It's part of an orientation, if you will. We need instruction. This helps to give us a sense of engagement until we can find our own direction, usually after a couple of years. I like to think after about 3 years, you begin to calm your thoughts and not be the enthusiast. You're over the initial excitement and are deepening your work. Training seems to be the next step. We train the mind. You may come to us with a talent to play a cello, and you're looking for a mentor to help your work because you think that you feel the results are helpful, and you're getting some kind of encouragement around you. That solitude that Einstein had told us about. And you learn that to take you to the next level requires a mentor that knows how to do that. Oh, we can wait and tell ourselves in our own bleak way that we are quite capable of being everything that is humanly possible without any education. And education is no more limiting than sitting down to 88 keys at a piano. You want the one with 101 keys? Well, we gave that up a while ago. So often, masonry hears your voice. You'd like to, that sonorous tones. You want to develop your ability as a cellist, do you? Well, we have all these pianos. We've been doing this a lot longer than you have. So put that instrument, your chosen instrument, down. We're going to teach you how to be a good pianist, a journeyman pianist. So, and that this is, by the way, Freemasonry. And all the other brethren are playing piano too. So what's wrong with you? What's wrong is, it's like thinking that there's a uniform pilgrimage. Oh, we're all the same. We're all pilgrims on that path. But our reasons? If you claim that the reasons that pull us together are of the highest ethical standard, then we find compromise. We find agreement. But we don't hear that around the lodges, do we? The instruction we give after the training, the instruction we give, the instruction is piano. We select the instrument. And oftentimes you'll hear somebody trying to tell you what should excite you and what you should do to find those insights, to be a real, true, good little mason. Except all of those efforts. Instruction is important. The training falls short of the desired goal. These aren't bad, bad fellows doing this. Because they've forgotten somehow that inspiration isn't something you tell to somebody. Read this book, it's going to inspire you. Read the book and then tell me, were you inspired? Look at this particular artwork. Maybe you like the work of Lauren Harris, Canadian. I don't blow our own horn here sometimes. And the question is, does it inspire you? Well, maybe your taste is to a Bauhaus. Maybe your taste is to something from an earlier period or impressionist. Okay, I can. Then you can talk about your inspiration, and then I can enjoy and share. I understand what inspiration feels like, and if you're capturing that, then we connect. And then there's education. Where you are the poet. You're looking for truths in the mathematics, in the geometry of the universe, and our place in it. Not because we are elevated to a higher standard, because we can think in the abstract. I like the notion that with wisdom, we become silent. I sat one day at a party, a very, very lovely couple had invited us. And it was all a room full of people that didn't really know, except the hosts. And I met this fellow that seemed to be very pleasant. We got along, and I was telling him about he was curious about my boat, so I was telling him little bits and pieces because my sailing experience at the time was a bit limited. And this young fella came along and overheard us and began to quite excitedly tell us and about his. And he was one of the very competitive kind of guy, obviously, and quite enjoying it. And then as he wandered off after he had taken over the conversation for a good hour, I talked to and listened to the fellow explain to me his sailing experience. He just returned from around the world trip, a small sailboat. No need to brag, no need to be competitive. You know, when men face dangers and perils and they have to rely on their own wits and abilities and they learn to respect the risk around them and nature, something that happens to them. That there's a truth that they know. And you begin to realize that not everybody does. Lesson learned a long, long time ago. So today, I'm not here to applaud your efforts. You know when you're doing something well for yourself. You know when you're holding back, which is likely that you've not given yourself a complete effort, a complete and fulsome effort at discovery. The mysteries? No mystery. The mystery is us. No question where it is. The mystery is us. What unlocks your thinking? You do. And how do you go about doing that? Maybe it's a baby's laugh or the truth exposed in poetry. No, you don't have to admit that you listen to poetry and you're trying to understand it. No, we wouldn't want anybody out, any louts or any of our buddies to laugh at us and think that we're effeminate because we listen to poetry. Oh my goodness. Because in the 18th and 19th century, nobody ever thought that you were effeminate if you read poetry, did they? Even though we came from times of brutality. For all that we're here, where I am, in a knowledge-based economy, a nation that's shifted, a young nation, and around the world we're wrapped in this incredibly stark pattern of communication that we catch up on. That if we're competitive, we want to get ahead of it and we'll be quite unhappy, but what's to compete? It's always going to be ahead. And it affects us greatly. So set about your work seriously. Nobody will challenge you. Recognize training and recognize instruction and training and education for what it is. There are different aspects. And begin to recognize how you learn as an individual. And don't be silly thinking that you're going to impose your will and your insight on everybody else. Is that really the way it works? In other words, you believe that insight and inspiration can be told to another man and that's going to make a difference? You really? Come. It's like being lost in the frisson of music. Just gorgeous. This is a time of reflection, and we hear people around us validating the ups and downs, the uncertainty of the world around us, and then we have this sense that we can prevail. Some of us can prevail. Oh, the ancient estates have failed us in large measure because of exposure. Oh, those darn iPhones. They can, every hobnailed boot of authority is photographed and held accountable. And it's not working so well anymore, is it? The battlefield is being taped and brought into people's homes instantly. Censorship is still there, but not just matter of truth and observation, without context, has really gotten beyond the control of the demagogues. New understanding, a reformation, a renaissance, if you will. I'll try and come back, I think, on Christmas Day with us. It's only a few days away, but with a program for you. In the meantime, I hope it's been useful in identifying some of the material that connects us with science, connects the arts and the science. And I look forward to having you join us again soon. It's an absolute pleasure to be part of the Brotherhood, and thank you for that. Thank you. we are in ages. We are in ages. Thank you.
Okay.